Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Billy, why don't we tell them what we're about, man?
So we're here to welcome you to the Madhouse Chronicles. It's a talk show with myself, Billy Morrison.
And me, Ozzy Osbourne.
This man, Prince of Darkness. And we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Come and join Ozzy and myself. Visit osbournemediahouse.com to get special access to...
Come on!
What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
Welcome to the Crack House Chronicles, your favorite true crime podcast. I am Donnie, and with me is a man that wants everyone to know that he used to drink beer a long time ago. Well, he still drinks beer today. He just wanted everyone to know that he drank beer a long time ago. It's Dale.
Hey, what's going on, man?
What's going on with you?
That's right, man.
Yeah, he just wanted everybody to know.
I want everybody to know.
Yeah.
What do you not know?
Yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
That's right. It is the gift that keeps on giving.
It is, man.
In and out. Get a nothing.
Yeah.
That's right, man. Yep. What's happening today?
Oh, recording an episode. What's happening with you?
Oh, man, it was a big day, wasn't it?
Yeah, me and Dale, we took a field trip today.
We did.
We did. We back in recording, but we went to the courthouse today.
It was really neat.
Very.
I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I've never been in a courtroom while real court was in session. I've been in one to recover all the benches and stuff when nobody's there. But as far as going there while the seriousness is going on, that was my first time witnessing that.
Well, they were planting if and defending if.
Yeah.
And stuff. Yeah, doing.
Yeah, except for Perry Mason, that's all I know. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, we went to part of a trial today.
Yeah, we went down to Shelby Courthouse and check it out and just walked in to kind of observe and see what was going on. We both had a little time this morning, so it was very interesting.
Yeah, there's a trial going on that me and Dale are familiar with, so we went in there and listened to a little bit of it.
Yeah, I wish we could have got more or stayed for a little more, but, you know, they broke pretty quick for lunch and we had to get back to you guys, so. We did what we could do, and we're here where we want to be.
Yep, that's right. But other than that, you got anybody shout-out or anybody you want to talk about?
Yeah, man, I do want to give our friend over at the Pretty Boy Floyd camp, you know, the band from the 80s and 90s is still going now. It's actually, they were kind of featured on the Peacemaker series with John Cena. I don't know if you saw that or not, but like he had a shirt or the girl had a shirt or whatever, and I guess they got a little resurgence off of that, a little bit of tension. But anyway, I hit him up and got a t-shirt from him and ended up found out that they had some records. And you know, I can't say no to records. And ended up buying a couple records, a couple albums, and then a couple 7-inch records too. And man, he sent me that and a couple shirts and a couple little extra goodies. So I just wanted to give our buddy Steve Summers, he's a lead singer for Pretty Boy Floyd, give him a shout out and tell him how much I appreciate what he did for me. Everything was signed. It was really cool.
Man.
Every record. And he actually sent me an extra CD too, no charge. And, it was all signed. Every one of them was signed. You know, it was really cool. So I text him back and told him how much I appreciated him, and I give him a shout out. And I'll throw a photo up of this my hall on our socials and a little more information. You can find him at Steve Summers on Facebook or Pretty Boy Floyd Band on Instagram.
And how great is it to have a hookup like that?
I don't know. It was amazing.
I bet it is.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
Super dude. Man.
Man, that's just
straight from him, you know, no store junk, message you and buy it and go on about your business.
No middleman or nothing.
Yeah, awesome. And it was really cool stuff, quality stuff. He had I got a couple shirts, and then he sent my wife a tank top shirt. It was really cool. And, man, it's just awesome.
That's awesome.
Anyway, thanks much, Stevie. I really appreciate that, man, and it's nice.
Hopefully he'll listen to this episode and listen to his shout-out.
Heck yeah, man. Y'all go over and give him a like and follow and all that good stuff like you do us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, listen to their music, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, if anybody wants to go to Apple Podcast and leave a 5-star rate and review, write something in the box. We'll give you a big old shout out here.
Hopefully all y'all getting Crack House stuff for Christmas.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if it's too late to buy stuff from the store for Christmas or not. I don't know.
By the time you hear this, probably will be.
Yeah, probably will, yeah.
Because it'll be, Monday?
Yeah. I did get a picture from Troy Friedale.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. One of our big listeners. I actually went to...
Is he big? How big is he?
Troy's a big guy.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he's pretty tall. He was tall in elementary school. But he sent me a picture. He's a big listener, and he bought some stocking stuffers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
So he listens to the show, and I'm going to give him a big old shout-out. He's a great guy.
I appreciate that. And then me and you stopped to eat lunch today and run into Jimmy Hensley. He run me down and told me he really enjoys the show and thought it was really good, and keep doing what we're doing. So thanks, Jimmy. It's good to see you, buddy.
We're doing what we're doing.
We're doing it, man. Speaking of, let's do it.
All right. We're going to get into this episode, bud.
We're going back to California, ain't we?
Yeah, because we're in the same area.
It's funny how that works, ain't it?
Yeah. Where we were talking about Bryce LaSpisa, his mm-hmm. episode.
Yeah.
The same general area.
Right in there.
But it's a little bit before Bryce's time.
Yes.
This is in February of 1978 we're talking about.
Okay.
Actually, on February the 24th of 1978. And this is when five young men from Yuba City, California, they attended a basketball game at California State University.
Yeah, that was their favorite basketball team.
Yeah, they were going to cheer UC Davis basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they were in an away game against Chico State.
Wow.
But these five guys, their names were Bill Sterling. He was 29 years old.
So this ain't real young men.
No, they were. A lot of people refer to them as the boys.
Right.
But they were grown men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bill, it's all hung out together.
Yeah. But Bill Sterling, he was 29. Jack Hewitt was 24. Ted Weir was 32. Jack Madruga was 30.
They called him Doc, right?
Yeah, they did.
Okay.
And Gary Mathias was 25. And like I said, they were going to cheer the UC Davis basketball team in an away game at Chico State.
Mm-hmm.
And their plan to see the game was to go see the game and then return home that night.
Well, it's kind of like a little inspiration because themselves, they had a big game the next morning.
They did.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they actually played on a Special Olympics basketball team.
They did.
And it was a pretty big tournament they were going to play in because the grand prize was an all-expense-paid trip for a week in Los Angeles.
Wow.
So this was a pretty big deal. And also, you know, Sally Struthers, the actress, she was pretty big at the time in Special Olympics. Mm. She was promoting it, you know, and this was during the All in the Family.
From All in the Family game. Yeah.
Gloria from All in the Family.
Exactly.
TV show. And she was supposed to make an appearance there, and I think the guys were going to have a chance to meet her.
She did a lot of charity work like that, didn't she?
She really did.
Feeding the hungry and this kind of stuff. So it's good for her.
Yeah. Like I said, they attended this basketball game, and their plan was to return home that night because they had that big game the next day of their own.
Yeah, and some of them were so excited they had actually laid their uniforms out on the bed the next morning.
They did.
For that night, so they'd be ready in the morning.
Yeah, but they never made it home, Dale.
Hmm.
Mm-mm. And several days later, the car that they were in, it was a 1969 Mercury Montego.
It's a pretty sweet ride.
Yeah. It was found abandoned in a remote area of Plumas National Park on a high mountain dirt road that was far from where they were supposed to be.
Yeah.
Actually in the opposite direction.
We'll get into it.
Yeah.
Shut up. Go ahead.
We're going to get into this episode and talk about what's going on with that, but we want to give a little better background on where we're at now.
Right.
But these guys, Gary Mathias, he had grown up in Yuba City and had joined the military in the early 1970s.
That's a Yuba, Yuba City.
Yuba, yeah.
Yeah.
And he had been stationed in West Germany, but he wasn't there long, and he developed a drug habit, Dale.
Pretty bad drug habit.
Yeah, which eventually led him to be diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he got a psychiatric discharge.
Yeah, I heard some people kind of compare it to what happened to Sid Barrett of Pink Floyd fame. You know, it was like a bunch of LSD or something was what happened to him, and I don't know what happened to Gary, but that's what happened to Sid Barrett. He had done so much LSD that it kind of pushed him over the edge into some kind of mental problem there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not saying it's what happened to this fellow, but could be something to that. Because, you know, if he was in the Army and he's already there and went stationed, you know, I'm sure he went through some stuff beforehand and they just didn't know.
Yeah, that's
true. Or he was either an undiagnosed one. You never know.
Could very well be.
Especially in the 70s.
But after he was discharged, Gary Mathias returned home and moved back in with his parents,
mm-hmm.
where he began treatment at a local mental hospital. And he had some rough starts there with that and trying to, I guess, get off the drugs and everything he was doing. He had some run-in with the law.
Well, he's probably trying to get off that kind of drugs, and they probably needed to get him on something else. But they had to figure out what's wrong first, I guess.
Yeah. But by 1978, Gary Mathias was pretty much on the right path and considered by his physicians to be a success story.
Yeah, because he had had several encounters with the law and then a couple of psychotic episodes. So I think it got him going in the right direction.
Yeah, because he was receiving disability pay for his time in the military. And also, he began to work at his stepfather's gardening business.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a future.
Everything was looking good.
It really was. But that wasn't all. Gary Mathias had managed to make some friends.
Okay.
With four other guys. And we mentioned them, but Sterling and Hewitt, of those five guys, they had a slight intellectual disability challenge, yeah. While Weir and Madruga were considered just slow learners.
Right.
But were also Army vets. But now these five guys, they were pretty tight. They hung out together, and that, like we said, everybody called them the boys.
Yeah.
There's the boys. The boys are going somewhere. The boys are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
But sports was their thing, man.
Yeah.
And basketball was their favorite pastime.
You know, and I thought that was, I heard a lot of other people talking about these boys being, you know, challenged and stuff like that. But if they're playing organized sports and stuff, and out there, especially basketball, running up and down the court and this stuff, you know, I think people don't give them enough credit, actually.
No.
You know, in some of the research I've done. But anyway, go ahead. My two cents.
Because two of these boys had driver's license.
And then been in the military.
Yeah. So they were pretty high-functioning guys.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of
people. So maybe it might have been some what you would call now like an autism or something. Or, you know, maybe, I don't know. Because, you know, in the 70s, they probably just labeled everybody the same. But, you know, I think, you know, especially for out there, they're very athletic guys and doing stuff. You know, I don't think they get the credit they could. I think a lot of people just want to label them something, but that's just mine.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But basketball was their favorite sport, and all five men were part of the Gateway Gators. This was a basketball team that was sponsored by a local program for the mentally handicapped.
Hmm.
So they were involved with that pretty heavy.
Right.
And if they weren't playing, they were watching. And if they weren't doing that, the men, they just hung out together.
Yeah. Whatever they did, they all did it together, I believe.
But due to their special needs, all of the five men live with their parents,
mm-hmm.
either in Yuba or nearby Marysville.
Right.
So we're moving up to February the 25th of 1978.
Alrighty.
And on February the 25th, the boys were due to play their first game in a week-long tournament sponsored by the Special Olympics, like we talked about.
Yep.
And the night before, we said some of the boys had laid their uniforms out.
Yeah, because they thought they weren't going to get back from the basketball game they were going to watch to. It might be a little bit late. So they wanted to make sure everything was ready, and they would just come home, go straight to bed, get up, and everything's ready to go.
Yeah, and they even told their parents, you know, we're going to get in late, so make sure you wake me up for this game.
That's right.
Yeah, they wanted to make sure they got up.
They didn't want to miss it. Very important.
Now, the boys, they made the 50-mile drive north from Yuba County to Chico.
Correct.
This was in Jack Madruga's 1969 Mercury Montego. It was turquoise color and had some white trim. That's what it's been described as.
Yes.
And it's a pretty sweet ride.
I think so.
Yeah. And I mean, you're talking about, you imagine having an 8-track player in that thing?
Yeah, boy. Just slam a tape in and roll.
You can roll out, man.
Get your alligator print 8-track case with the red interior.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sweet.
Yeah, it'll be all right. Just sit in the back seat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think everybody done that.
Look like a tackle box.
Yeah. But the only clothes they wore was just light coats.
Yeah.
You know, the temperatures were pretty cold. This was February.
It was cool. But, it, you know, some of the boys had said, well, some of the parents of the boys had said that they had ever actually asked them to wear a coat. And they was like, well, we're not stopping anywhere. We're just going straight to the game and straight back, unless we stop and get a snack or something. But we're not planning on doing anything. So they said, we're fine. We're not wearing a coat.
Or being outside for any length of time.
Right.
Yeah. And the last game of the night ended at 10 p.m. And the boys, they started their journey home. But not before stopping at a store. This was a couple blocks away from where the game was being played. And the store was called Bears Market. Behr's.
Correct.
Market. And they were going to get some road snacks.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they were spotted there, the storekeeper was about to close the store.
Mm.
And when they went into the store, I think it annoyed her a little bit. They came in and were just looking around. Like, I'm ready to go home.
You know, they're browsing. She's trying to close it down.
Yeah, I'm ready to go to the house.
I've been there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. People come in at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very significant that, you know, she spotted these guys, and I guess being annoyed like that, you would
remember it.
Definitely remember it. Yeah. But they were in that store and they stocked up on some snacks. They got some pies, chocolate bars, some soda, and some milk.
And some milk.
I think it was 2.5 quarts of milk they got. And then they hit the road home.
Yep.
And their families all expected these guys to be back that night. And some of their parents even waited up for them to return.
Oh, I don't blame them.
But when the morning arrived, they hadn't shown up.
Nope.
And the police were notified.
Yeah, ooh, getting worried.
So police from both Butte and Yuba counties searched the route for the men they had taken.
Yeah.
But there were no sign of them.
No.
Nothing. And on February the 28th, a Plumas National Forest ranger who had seen the Montego called in the police.
So this is 3 days later.
Right? Yeah.
Okay.
And he assumed it was the car from the cross-country skiers, as was common for that time of year.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody just left it.
Yeah, he had no idea whose it was until he sent it 2 or 3 days later when he heard that they were looking for him.
Yeah, until he saw the bulletin and he knew otherwise. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And inside the car, the deputies found the doors to be unlocked with the window rolled down.
Driver's door.
Yeah.
Window, yeah.
Yeah, which is weird.
Very.
And inside they found the food wrappers, the candy wrappers and stuff, in empty cartons and cans. And also the programs from the basketball game there in Chico.
Yeah, and one of them even had like the score written down on the back of it, the final score.
Yep. And a neatly folded road map of California was in there also.
Hmm.
Yep. And the goodies they had bought at Bear's Market were all consumed except a half of a marathon bar.
I guess they only could go half marathon.
I guess. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's pretty good, though.
It's a real good candy bar, though.
Yeah. Do they still make marathon bars?
They don't.
Mm-mm. Yeah, it was a good candy bar.
Yeah. Like a $100,000 bar.
Yeah. But now get this, Dale. The car was stuck in snowdrifts with signs of spinning under the tires.
Right. But it wasn't very deep snow. It was just, from what I heard when they, you know, went with it was just kind of off the road a little bit in snow. And them five big dudes, they should have been able to push it out of that snow.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah, because the police noted that the snow wasn't that deep.
No, it was just a little spin thing because they hadn't got up into where I don't think where it was deep.
Mm-mm.
It was weird. It's kind of odd. Basically, what they did is like a mountain road. They would went up, and when they get up so far, this mountain had a snow cap on the top. So
yeah.
They were going fine, not a very nice road, but then all of a sudden you run into snow.
It's snow line, yeah.
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 So it may be snowing up there. I don't know. But they run into snow.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like it was snowing when they left the ball game. You know what I mean?
That's right.
Okay.
But now the car keys were missing, and it suggested to the police that they may have run into some car trouble and went to get some help. But the police, they hot-wired the car.
Yeah, and it started right up.
Yeah, it cranked right up.
And it had a quarter tank of gas.
Yeah. So
that's a fourth to you and me.
It is.
Yeah. So what we got now is a car that's kind of stuck in the snow that could have been easily pushed out, and the wind is down, the doors are unlocked, the keys are gone. But yet the car starts up immediately and has gas in it.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is odd.
I guess the car led to more questions than answers because the first was, why was the car there?
Yeah, because this is the biggest question of, I think the biggest question of the whole damn thing, but it doesn't make any sense for this car to be here. It is totally the not way to go home.
No, 70 miles in the opposite direction.
70.
70.
That's 20 miles further than their original trip.
Yeah.
Hmm. And we'll post a picture of this because basically, when they left home in Yuba City and drove to Chico, it's basically a straight shot north. And I'm not sure the mileage, but it runs straight up into another highway, and then you turn left, and it takes you straight to where the game was. So it's only like one major turn.
Yeah, so they shouldn't have had any problem getting there and back.
No, but when you see a map of where they went, it makes no sense at all.
None.
Why they would be there.
No.
Because they would go, when you had to turn around and come back down that road, you go past the original turn, you'll go down past another turn and keep going down, and then it turns left and then kind of goes into this national forest, goes out and looks like it goes like kind of across a part of a lake, and then it's just a mountain road. It goes up into the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense at all. I don't understand.
This is the Sierra Mountains.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big mountains, dude.
Wow.
And the men, they weren't prepared for this kind of adventure at all, Dale.
Well, no. We already established they didn't have a coat on.
No.
I mean, even if they did, it's snowing.
That's right. And why would the boys have taken an off-road joyride of the night?
If that's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, no idea. I mean, I'm sure these questions are just because you can't figure out no other reason why they was there. It just, I don't know.
But Jack McDruga, he hated the cold weather and never been up to the mountains before.
Right. So, you know, he wouldn't like voted to go there.
No. And Bill Sterling had gone on a fishing trip with his father near there once, but he didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, so he never went back.
No.
So it wasn't like, hey, let's go up here where me and Dad went fishing. He didn't want to go with his dad. He darn sure don't want to go just to go while they should be getting home to go to bed so they can go for the basketball game the next day.
Mm-hmm. But they ended up towing the car, and when they got it to where they could look up underneath the car, they found there were no dents, gouges, or even scrapes on the undercarriage or the low-hanging muffler, despite being up this rocky road.
So you'd think they weren't flying up the road.
No.
They was gingerly going around rocks and ruts.
Yeah, because, you know, you had five guys in this car. It's going to be weighted down.
Yeah.
You know.
Athletic guys.
Yeah. So either they took it really slow up this mountain road with all these gouges and rocks.
Or got really lucky.
Yeah, or there was somebody else drove that car up there, a single person.
Hmm. Dum, dum, dum.
You know, that's a theory.
That is a theory.
Yeah.
But we do know that the boys were in the car when they left the store because all the rappers in the basketball program with the score on it. So you know it was one from the game. Okay.
Yep.
But we don't know, like you said, who put the car there. Gotcha.
So like I said, either the driver had been very careful or it was someone familiar with the road enough to get the car up there on this
closer to, hell, it had to be 11 o'clock at night by now.
Yeah.
If the game was over at 10, they stopped at the store and drove 70 miles, it's probably midnight now.
Mm-hmm.
Pushing it. Okay.
Now, there's another thing, too. Jack McDruga, that owned this car, the 69 Mercury Montego, was incredibly protective of his car.
His pride and joy.
He wouldn't let anyone else drive it.
I don't blame him. That thing's sweet.
Yeah. And he wouldn't let the car unlocked.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so, with the window down.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to leave it unlocked if the window's rolled down, because what do you care then?
Yeah, that's true. But he was very protective of this car.
Hmm.
So while the car was being investigated, any efforts to explore the area were hampered by a severe snowstorm.
Yeah, it's bad.
And 2 days later, after searchers and snowcats nearly got lost themselves, further efforts were called off due to the bad weather.
Yes, yeah, so actually, they had like a lot of people up there helping, and actually two of the searchers, you know, almost lost their lives getting lost in there, and it was a bad storm.
Yeah. So there's no sign of the boys at all.
No, nothing.
And the families, they put up a reward for $1,215.
You know, it's odd. Well, not really odd, but it's a shame they couldn't, you know, get a run across them earlier. But when, you know, they were thinking, hell, we searched everywhere, but all they searched was that straight shot to the basketball game and back.
Yeah.
They had no idea these boys was 70 miles off course.
That's true. But the family did put up a reward for $1,215, which is almost $5,000 today.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for any information to the missing boys.
Yeah.
And the story had been widely broadcast in the area, and the police received dozens of tips.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Yep. But there was a police officer. His name was Lieutenant Ayers. And all these tips were coming in. He was punching holes in all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like,
hey, he was skeptical but desperate. Well, they consulted psychics, and one told him that the boys had been kidnapped to Arizona or Nevada. And another said the boys had been murdered in Oroville in a two-story red house, either bricked or stained wood with a gravel driveway with the number 4723 or 4753.
Hmm.
Now, get this. This Lieutenant Ayers, for two solid days, he drove the streets of Oroville looking for that house that house number.
And it did not exist.
No. So that's what they were dealing with.
He's putting in the damn time, though, isn't
he? He definitely is.
Credit where it's due, man.
But there were two tips that stood out to him.
Hmm.
There was a store in a small town of Brownsville. This was about 30 miles from where the car had been found, that the men could have easily made it there if they had turned around and followed the road down from where the car was found.
Yeah.
It was on March the 3rd. One of the store employees called the police and told them that she had seen four of the men stop at the store in a red pickup truck 2 days after they disappeared. And she identified the men immediately as out-of-towners due to their big eyes and facial expressions. That's what she went on. Yeah.
So it made you be out of town.
Yeah. I guess I'm from out of town everywhere.
Yeah.
But two of the men that she identified as Hewitt and Sterling had went to a phone booth outside the store where the other two men had went inside.
Hmm.
And the store owner corroborated this story, saying the two men who came into the store were Weir and Hewitt, and they bought a couple burritos, chocolate milk, and soft drinks. And both witnesses were deemed credible.
Huh.
But this left many questions. Who was the driver of the red truck? And if they'd been there 2 days after they disappeared, why hadn't they contacted their family?
Right. So they're saying 2 days after they found the car, knew they were disappeared, that they showed up at this store in a red truck.
Yeah. That's okay. What they're saying. Yeah.
Okay. Just to be clear, this is 2 days after the disappearance.
I'm going to tell you, Dale, this story is weird because there's little stories within this story.
This is a plot of subplots.
Yes, it is, because there was another tip the police received that was pretty bizarre.
Huh.
There was a guy by the name of Joseph Shawns.
Right.
He was from Sacramento, and he had inadvertently ended up spending the night of February the 24th in his car near where the Montego was found.
Hmm.
He had driven up in the mountain where he had went to look for a cabin, guest for a place for his family to camp. And he was up there looking. It's what the story says.
Right.
So at about 5:30 p.m., 150 feet up the road from where the Mercury Montego was found, he had gotten stuck in the snow. He was in his Volkswagen Beetle.
Yeah, which is pretty good in the snow.
Yeah. And in the process of trying to get his car free after getting stuck, he realized that he was having the early symptoms of a heart attack.
Yeah.
So he got back in his car and left the engine running to stay warm.
Yeah, he got out there trying to push his car and felt it coming on.
His arm
went numb and all that stuff.
Yeah. And 6 hours later, he was lying in the car in severe pain.
Hmm.
And he heard what he described as whistling noise in a way down the road. And he got out of his car and he looked like a group of men and a woman with a baby.
Walking around the snow?
Yeah. Hmm. That's what he was saying.
Okay.
And he thought he heard them talking, and he yelled for help because he was experiencing a heart attack. But the headlights went out, and they stopped talking. So Joseph Shawns got back in his Volkswagen Beetle and laid down again. Now, he said he laid in the car until it ran out of gas. And then, while it was still dark, he walked back 8 miles to the lodge called Mountain House.
8 miles?
He walked. I guess he recuperated enough from this heart attack to walk 8 miles to a lodge called Mountain House, where he had stopped for a drink before heading up the road. And just before his Volkswagen...
He stopped for a drink on his way in?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
He stopped at this place on the way in.
Okay.
So he walked back down after the heart attack.
I thought we were saying he walked back from his heart attack and stopped in to have a drink on his way to wherever he's going.
No.
Okay.
He went back to where he came from, and he remembered that Mountain House, right. A lodge, yeah.
8 miles.
After having experienced a heart attack, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'd just be in the car.
But doctors later confirmed that Joseph Shawns indeed suffered a mild heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
But this Joseph Shawns, you know, him saying that he saw people with flashlights and headlights and things, you know, and him experiencing a heart attack, I'm sure some of that could be delusions.
Could be. Could be lying.
Yeah.
Could be a lot of things.
Yeah, I just don't know. They consider it pretty credible, but I just don't know how credible some of that is.
We'll get into that in theories.
On June the 4th of that year, Dale, most of the higher elevation snow had melted, and a group of motorcyclists, they had went up to a trailer in the mountains that was maintained by the Forestry Service.
Right.
And the trailer was at a campsite, and it was a popular pit stop and resting place for hikers in the park.
Right. Because we're still talking about a national forest here.
Yeah. And the motorcyclist had noticed the front window of a 60-foot trailer had been broken out.
Hmm.
And when they opened the door, they got a smell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty rough.
Yeah, it was something dead.
Yep.
And they were pretty much overcome by the intense odor of decay.
Right.
And upon discovery, they contacted the police. This little camp was off the road about 19.4 miles from where the car had been found, the Mercury Montego.
So 20 miles.
Yeah, let's say 20 miles, rounded up to 20 miles.
Ooh.
And recovery teams spent half a day clearing huge trees from the roadway before reaching the trailer. So this is pretty inaccessible.
Right. Yeah. It was just a campsite or way up into wherever, I guess, in case you need shelter and you can't get it. So they just kind of, it's up there and in stock.
That's right.
And the area was searched following the road between the trailer and the site of the Montego. And the next day, they found remains of Madruga and Sterling on the opposite sides of the road. This was 11.4 miles from where the Mercury Montego had been left. And the bodies had been scavenged by animals, but what remained was autopsies and showed up that both had died of hypothermia.
See, you know, I know there wasn't much left of them, so I always wondered, how do you tell?
Yeah, I don't know. This was 1978.
Yeah.
I just don't know how they could determine that back then.
But I've wondered that, so maybe we need to get a
forensic person.
Yes.
Yeah. Find out that stuff.
How do you know that? Yeah.
So 2 days later, as part of a search party, Hewitt's father was out there helping him.
Huh.
Yeah, and he made a grisly discovery.
Yeah.
He found his son's coat.
Under some bushes.
His jacket. And when he picked it up, his son's backbone fell out of it.
Yeah. Man, that'd be rough.
His shoes and jeans were nearby, and they helped identify the body. And the next day, the deputy sheriff found his skull down the hill in some brush. It was about 300 feet away.
Wow.
Yeah. It's crazy, man.
It is.
Now, roughly a quarter mile northwest of the trailer, searchers found 3 wool Forest Service blankets and a 2-cell flashlight laying beside the road.
Hmm.
And the flashlight was slightly rusted and had been turned off. It was impossible to tell just how long it had been there, Dale.
Right, so we don't really know if this came from one of these men or not. It's very possible because they probably would have got the blankets from that, you know, that trailer.
Yep.
And the flashlight, I would assume, because I'm sure they didn't have one in the car.
That's right. Now, getting back to the trailer, Ted Weir's body had been found in the trailer on a bed.
Yeah, that was the source of
the smell.
The smell,
yeah. And he'd been wrapped in 8 sheets.
8.
Including his head.
Right. So this is going to tell you at least one thing. He didn't wrap himself up.
No. It'd been like he was mummified.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah, wrapped up. Somebody had wrapped him up in 8 sheets.
Yeah.
And autopsy had showed that he had died of a combination of starvation and hypothermia. And Ted Weir had lost nearly half of his body weight, which was 200 pounds. He'd lost almost 100 pounds.
Hmm.
And also, it showed that his beard growth, it showed that he had at least lived 13 weeks since he'd last shaved.
Right. Yeah, I saw it was like 8 to 13, which is a pretty big gap, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess maybe beard growth is different for different folks, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
But I also did hear that when they unwrapped him, that most of his face was already had been decayed and gone. So I guess maybe his beard was still there. I don't know how that works. But anyway, and his feet were really bad.
Yeah, they were frostbitten bad.
Yeah.
And even some of the toes had fell off.
Yeah, 5.
Yeah.
And he was kind of gangrenous.
Yeah.
Is that a word? Gangrenous.
Yeah, gangrene.
Yeah.
Yeah. And on the table next to the bed where Ted Weir was laying, his personal effects were still there, including his wallet with some cash in it.
Yeah.
A nickel ring with Ted engraved on it and a gold necklace that he frequently wore was still there on that little nightstand. But also there were...
So he got money and jewelry still there. Okay.
Yeah, and also there was a gold watch without its crystal, which the Weir family said did not belong to him, and they didn't know where it came from.
And a partially melted candle?
Yes.
Well, that watch maybe could have been there from maybe a ranger or something had left it there previously. Maybe he busted it working on something and just happened to leave it there or something.
That's true.
Because it's kind of, I won't say it's not like a public thing, but it kind of is.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been left by anybody.
Right.
Yeah. And Ted was wearing a velour shirt, lightweight pants, but his shoes could not be found.
No. There were some shoes there.
Yeah.
Well, outside the door, which is kind of odd.
But they weren't his shoes.
No, they weren't.
Mm-mm.
He had like some leather boot kind of shoes, I think he was wearing, and those were tennis shoes, I think.
So him being in a trailer, they were trying to figure out how Ted could have possibly died and gotten starvation and hypothermia. They was trying to figure this out. And they come to realize that no fire had been set in the fireplaces.
This is the saddest part of this dang story, man.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not the saddest part, but this part breaks your heart, right?
Because there was a fireplace, and they had plenty of supply of matches and paperback novels that could have been used as kindling.
Yeah.
And there was stuff there to burn.
Right.
Yeah. And there was also heavy forestry clothing, which the men could have worn to keep warm.
Yeah.
And they were untouched.
I think some of that stuff was in a separate trailer, though, right? It was like in a little storage trailer.
Yeah.
They had like some torches and a lot of the fire stuff and some clothing and that kind of stuff. So, maybe they didn't. I don't know. It's just odd. Go ahead.
Yeah. We're going to talk about all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, there was a dozen sea ration cans. This is Army food.
Yeah, it's not SEA, sea rations. It's C, like letter dash C.
Rations.
Yeah. Because I was first heard them like, sea rations? Okay, I get it now.
Yeah, sea rations. And these were cans from a storage shed outside, had been opened and their contents consumed. So somebody had eaten these sea rations.
Right. It was in a second separate shed.
Yep. And there was a locker in the same shed held an even greater assortment of dehydrated foods, enough to keep all five of these men alive for a year.
A year.
A year's worth of food for five people.
And then it was untouched.
Yeah.
Now, they did find some cans and stuff outside the door, those bikers, you know, where they had eaten some food.
Yeah.
But they starved to death, and there was a whole damn enough to feed them all for a year right in the next trailer.
Yeah. And another shed nearby.
Right, the one I was talking about first.
Yeah, held a butane tank with a valve. And had it been opened, it would have fed the trailer's heating system.
Yeah, it had a heating system. So it didn't even really have to build a fire. It had a heating system in there. All you do is go turn the gas on.
Yeah.
And, so, and, you know, you'd think, you know, a couple of these guys were military guys. They had some kind of training. You know, some kind of. It's just. Questions.
And there was a P-38 can opener. This is an Army can opener. Them guys that had been in the military, they would have been instructed at some point how to use this thing.
Right.
And it was discovered that it was used to open some of the cans.
Mm-hmm.
But there was another can opener there, too, that had been used. So they had some knowledge to be able to function to...
Save yourself.
Yeah. Operate a can opener like that.
And set something on fire.
Yeah.
At least for a little while. I don't know if it'd last 6 months or whatever, but hell, for a while. Of course, you set enough stuff on fire, surely somebody'd see it, you know, eventually.
See a smoke or something, yeah. And it also seemed that Ted Weir had not been alone in the trailer, and that Gary Mathias and possibly Jack Hewitt had been there with him.
Hmm.
And Mathias' tennis shoes were in the trailer,
okay.
And the sea rations had been opened with the P-38 can opener, like we talked about.
So they're thinking that at least the one military guy was there using this can opener?
Yes, that's what they're thinking.
Okay.
Yeah. And he would have been familiar with it, too.
Right. Well, we know that somebody else is there because you can't wrap yourself up, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Like we said, the sheets were over Ted's body. Also suggested that one of the others had been there with him to, you know, tend to his feet and would have... You know, covered him up.
Yeah, because he know he can't do nothing. He wasn't definitely walking out to no another trailer. So it had to be whoever was there would have to be taking care of him to go get what they get before whatever happened to them.
That's right. But all that was left to do was find Gary Mathias' body. But after 2 weeks and with little progress made, investigators called off the search on June 19th of 1978, leaving his emotionally battered family without any closure at all. And other than Gary Mathias' shoes in the trailer, there was no evidence of him in the area.
Wow.
And it was presumed that he would have not taken his medication with him. There were pictures of him distributed around the area. Even mental institutions got his picture to try to maybe he saying that he might have shown up there.
Well, that's pretty smart.
Yeah.
Because even if he was on his medication and even if he had some with him, it wouldn't have been enough to last.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have slowly spiraled back to where he was.
Yep. And they were desperate to find these guys. They even, you know, like I said, they had that psychic that come in and tried to tell them some things. They also took on a water witcher.
Hmm.
Yeah, this is a technique also known as dowsing. And from the town north called Paradise, they called in somebody to be able to do that. And this is where they take a limb from a tree.
So it's like a divining rod?
Yeah.
Okay.
They take a limb from a tree in the area, and they make it into a shape of a Y with two branches you hold in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And they're out there trying to find traces of human minerals. That's what they're trying to do. Yeah.
I never heard of that. I was like looking for water or something, but I don't know about never looking for.
But yeah, they were trying to find human remains with it. Yeah.
Weird.
But they did find a gray cigarette lighter, the disposable plastic kind, with about 3/4 of a mile northwest of the trailer. and the family said none of the boys carried a lighter.
Right. So two bodies they found fairly close to the car, wasn't it?
They did.
Well, I mean, I'm not fairly close, but a lot closer than it would be to the cabin. And another body in the cabin, and then the next body was actually above and then to the east of the cabin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
On a 20-mile trek.
Yeah, this, they were spread out pretty good.
And from what we understand is this cabin, even though it was 20-mile trek from the car, there was a second trail that was only like 11 miles that went to that same cabin, but it was more of a steep, rockiest thing. And the other one was kind of a windy, flatter trail that kind of wound around and then come back in from the top side,
mm-hmm.
back into that thing. That's why we'd been so far. But, man, a 20-mile trek in the damn snow.
Can you imagine?
With no coat?
No.
And basketball shoes?
Yeah, just regular, yeah, just shoes. Mm-hmm. Maybe one pair of socks.
Yeah, that's it.
It's going to be cold, dude.
Yeah. Well, and the thing about it, 100 foot back down the mountain the other way, there was no snow.
No. They were going up a mountain hitting the snow line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it ain't like it was a snowstorm. They got up there and there was snow all over. They turned around and went back down the hill 100 foot. There's no snow. And then 8 miles, like that one guy, to the lodge. But they continued to go north into the snow.
Yeah.
Or at least that's where they were found.
Yeah. But why would they abandon a perfectly operable car?
I don't know, dude.
To strike out into the forest at midnight.
I don't know. Uh-uh. Something is up.
Yeah, this makes no sense at all.
No.
Now, there was one theory that Gary Mathias, he had some friends in a small town near there called Forbestown.
Hmm.
And it is possible that he wanted the guys to stop there for a visit on the way home. But they did talk to the friends that he knew there in Forbestown, and all of them said they hadn't seen Gary in several years. And they didn't think it would be any reason for him to come by.
I don't believe that.
You know, late at night.
No. Not when they already knew it was going to be late getting home.
And they had that big game the next day.
Big game the next morning. All they wanted to do was go see their favorite game, help out their favorite team, help them, would inspire their play the next day. They was going to get home late, get home, jump into bed, and go play the game.
Yeah.
So I don't know about that theory.
And people ask, you know, what about the report of the trip to the store in Brownsville? You know, this is the pickup truck that was spotted there
right.
2 days after the disappear. Now, Ted Weir's brother said that while driving to Brownsville in a different car, in apparent ignorance of the basketball games they were supposed to be playing that week seemed completely out of character for them. The owner's description of the two men's behavior seemed consistent with them, as Weir would have eat anything he could get his hands on.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, they bought the burritos and all that yeah. stuff, is what they said, and was often accompanied by Hewitt more than any of the other four, so they were pretty good tight
yeah,
friends. Yeah.
I don't know about this story either. This is 2 days after they disappeared. To me, this, I don't know, this kind of sounds like I seen a poster and we'll say they were here.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they didn't like to use telephones anyway, you know?
And also Jack Hewitt's brother said that his brother hated using phones.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he didn't want to do it. He didn't want to have nothing to do with them. And if he had to do a call, you dial it and hand him the receiver.
Yeah.
It wasn't a cell phone gimmick. It was just somebody dial the number and give it to him because he just didn't want to. He didn't want nothing to do with it. So I don't believe that either.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people question Joseph Shones, the yeah. heart attack guy.
Yeah, I don't blame him.
Yeah. Now, Ted Weir's mom, she had a hard time believing that her son would ignore somebody's call for help.
Right.
You know, if he'd been present, this might having a heart attack or something. But she believed that he would have done everything he could do to help him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she said she would remember the time, and one time he had run across somebody that was trying to get to the hospital because they had overdosed on Valium, and he actually helped them get to the hospital, get help to
yeah.
save her life. Yeah, this heart attack guy, there's been more come out about him that we've read about or found in research that he was known to do that a lot, and he would go out and go drinking and then go riding around and get stuck or whatever, and said that a lot of people would stop and help him, but he was always real bitter toward anybody who wanted to help him, never thankful and this stuff. So it just got to where he would remain stuck for more because people just didn't want to go help him because it's just the way he was and the way he treated him. And so I don't really buy that. Now, he did go to the hospital, and they said that he actually had some symptoms and stuff of it. Looked like he had a heart attack, but it may not have been that night.
Yeah.
He might have had the heart problems, and maybe he just used that as a cover for being out drunk riding around, because they did go back and check about the cabins. That he said he was out there searching about a cabin for him and his family going on vacation. There was no cabin. He didn't own one, nor had he rented one.
Oh.
So that was all BS, too.
Yeah. And a lot of people ask, how did these guys get to that trailer? And it was a day before the men went missing. The Forestry Service used a snowcat along the road in that direction to clear the snow off the trailer roof so it would not collapse.
Right. They went up there and checked on it.
Yeah.
So that right there tells me they probably wouldn't, since I wouldn't think they took that up the shorter 11-mile track that's steeper and more hard to climb. They would have went the long way to drive that thing up there, therefore leaving tracks.
Yeah.
Or leaving a, even if it snowed a little bit on top of it, that thing would have made, you know, because it's kind of like the bulldozer track on it. Yeah. Not quite that big, but
mash everything down.
Yeah, and you would see the track, so it would leave a imprint, like for them to follow to go to the cabin.
That's right.
Way I look at it. So that right there would tell me, you know, that's why. Of course, if you're just getting out in midnight and running through the snow, you don't know where you're going, no way. But if you see some type of, heck, I don't know if it didn't have any lights. I don't know really, but maybe you could see a little bit if you get adjusted to see a track in the snow instead of running straight through the woods.
Yeah,
I don't know. This is just crazy.
You know, me and you had a theory on this. When we've looked at a lot of stuff, but one theory me and you talked about was when they left this game or during that game at Chico State.
Yeah.
It is possible that these guys, the guys we're talking about, maybe encountered some other guys.
Yeah.
With some nefarious intentions.
Yes.
And maybe some words were exchanged.
Yeah, and, you know, a couple of them guys were best friends, and they would really take up for each other, because I'm sure back in the 70s they were getting picked on a good bit, and therefore they would take up for one another.
Especially having mental disabilities and stuff.
Right, yeah, that's what I mean, back in then, you know, because it's not like now. And I'm sure if that would have happened at the game and they kind of got into it and then they took up for one another and it could have escalated a little bit, maybe they left, went to that store, came out, and maybe they were there.
Yeah.
And then what, you know? That's what we talked about, you know, is, well, hell, maybe they went to the store, got their snacks, come out, and those guys were in the parking lot. Maybe they jump in and then took off, and that's why they went the wrong way.
Yeah.
That, to me.
And the guys are saying, just keep driving.
Yeah. And then they turned on that road to get away, and then they ended up, it's basically, on I guess it's a dead end. It don't run, well, hell, it have to be. It runs into the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
It's like an old logging road or something, is the way it, in my mind. So that theory to me seems most logical, that they were running from something. Why would it that way? They get, oh no, the car's stuck. We ain't got time to get it out. We just jump out and run. Because when they found the driver of the car, he still had the keys in his pocket.
Yeah.
When they found his body. So he had the keys with him. Somebody didn't take his keys. So somebody else didn't drive it up there unless he put the keys back in his pocket.
That's true.
Because he had his keys.
So that's what I'm thinking. Somebody chased them, and they got out of the car and ran, getting away.
That's what it sounds like.
And the car got to spinning a little bit, and they freaked out.
Yeah. They could have easily got it out and went back down the hill, but maybe they were scared to go back down the hill.
Yeah. Them guys are waiting on us.
Yeah. We got to get away. To me, and that may be way off base, but that's the only thing in my mind that makes any sense of why they would be 70 miles the wrong way.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I don't know. Did somebody go and chase somebody for 70 miles? I don't know. Maybe did they run into somebody and just got scared and just kept going and was scared to turn around? I don't know that either. But if you guys got any theories, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah. But, you know, even if one or two of them or three had made it to the trailer where they had the food and the forestry blankets and stuff and the fireplace, you know, they had enough sense about them to...
Somebody could have got that fire going.
Yeah, to stay warm. And the window that was busted out in that trailer for them to get in, they didn't even put nothing over it.
Right. So you think maybe they were scared to start a fire? Somebody then they'll know where we are?
If they were that scared, I don't know, dude.
And there's the two guys that were fairly near the car, you think that's as far as they made it? Or do you think they went to the trailer, and they're all in the trailer, and then what's his name's not doing good, we got to go out of here, and then they leave, and then one is not far from the trailer on top of the mountain, that's as far as he made it, and the other two made it almost back to the car, and that's as far as they made it?
It's very possible.
Before the hypothermia got them?
So we got to find help.
Yeah. Because I don't know that jumping out of the car, you know, and they would it would have got them that quickly as far as going up the hill.
Yeah.
And I'm not, I wish I had distances, but I don't. I've seen a map of where, you know, of the area and where the bodies were found, but I don't have exact distances, like from the car to where the first two bodies were found.
It's just a crazy story, man. It's four of the guys were found deceased, but Gary Mathias, his remains have never been found.
Yeah, dead or alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't know.
He ain't been found, period.
Nothing right. About him.
You know, they were said there was the thing about his shoes being there and then the other fella's not. Well, the other fella, as far as I know, if I'm correct, he had like a leather boot type shoe.
Yes.
So maybe, you know, he's like, well, he's not going to use those shoes. And I have tennis shoes that are probably soaked to the bone. Well, maybe if he's been there for a while, they wouldn't be. But that's definitely not what you want to wear if you got the option. Put on a pair of leather boots or wear your tennis shoes out in the snow. I mean, of course, leather boots are going to get wet too eventually, but
yeah, it's a little more, feet dry.
A little more protection than what you got.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why the shoes are there, but we still don't know where he went.
No, they have never found his remains or him or anything.
Not a trace.
But this is a crazy story, the Yuba County Five.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and there's other theories where maybe they thought that maybe he was off his medication and something happened and he killed him. But I don't buy that.
No. I think freaked out and killed him.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think so.
No.
I've been wrong before, but it just don't feel right to me.
No, I think they were scared something was after them and they took off and a couple of them made it to that trailer.
Yeah.
And lived for a while and just
succumbed. None of the